Well, actually, the first hour and about the 20 minutes of the second hour, we can cover the subject by then. And then we're going to dismiss the auditors. Maybe we'll have to finish. And then the head students want to stay behind, they want to be good. We got a big midpoint. Wake up. You had to dress up just for the class.
Christian Science is a cult which is not particularly as not as important as, say, Mormonism or Jehovah's Witness. One thing is smaller, another thing is dying. And another thing, it is old. We're going to talk about that. But yet I think we need to cover it. At one time, it was a very important cult. It was very powerful, yeah.
When you said it was dying, you had young people?
No, really. Oh, you thought I was kidding. Before we get any farther, I think we have to have any conclusion. I think we ought to know what Christian Science means. By the term science, because that word is such a holy word today, science, let me point out that when we say Christian Science, of course, it has nothing whatever to do with test tubes and biology class and science in that sense. It's from the Latin word scientia, Latin, which means knowledge. It simply means knowledge. We'll come back to that later. Christian Science is Christian knowledge. You understand that? That's what they mean by it. Christian way of looking at the universe. A Christian way of looking at reality. A Christian kind of knowledge has nothing to do with science. The normal thing. Okay? Now, look at your bibliography there. And, this is the standard book of Christian Science. Science and Health are the key to Scripture. I think I told you before, just be aware of the word key when it's used in this kind of context. Remember, Thomas W. Armstrong said it's the identification of the United States and Great Britain as Israel, lost Israel, was the key to understanding the Bible. And you often, a typical cult, they got this key to the Bible. Remember, they say so, like this. First, the problem is the truth about the matter is the Bible is not locked. There's a secret code to be broken. You understand, you know? But that's sort of the general approach. Now, I'm going to mention some other books. This is a book written this is an example of a book written by the Christian scientist. Mary Baker Eddy, Years of Trial. That's, of course, takes the pro-Christian Science view. They sent this to me. I gave a lectureship up in Orange Park some years ago, and some Christian on cults, some Christian scientists showed up, and I got this on mail so they got home. I appreciate it. The letter. I'm going to talk more about this book later. It's the best, if you want to, the best book of out on Christian Science. This is an example of the kind of stuff you get at Christian Science reading room. And this is a feeling. This is Christian Science Publishing Company. You can see an example of this kind of stuff. One more word before we begin, that the while Christian Science is known for, it was known for its practice of healing, it's a faith healing cult. while it is, that's sort of, nobody takes it seriously in that regard anymore, I would point out that the modern doctrine of faith healing, not the biblical doctrine that God's there, but the, you know what I mean by that, faith healing. Now, they practice exactly the Christian Science practice, only use the word for it, but the same thing. So that the study of Christian Science is important in that regard. We'll come to that later. Now, there are the major books on the subject. A, the Cult of Authority. I'll list that for you. Mary Baker, MBE, means Mary Baker Eddy, says, quote, no human pen or tongue taught me the science contained in this book, Science and Health, and from God. That's the standard claim. You've seen it, have we not? Mary Baker Eddy claimed that her book was the only infallible interpretation of the Word of God. Infallible because she got it directly from God. That's pretty straightforward, isn't it? Now, I look at the general history, and the source of this is the book, is this book. Now, as I say in the look on the, in our syllabus on the, under bibliography, this book was first published serially in McClure's magazine, the years 1907, 1908. Now, it was published while Mary Baker Eddy was still alive. You can tell that by reading the book, including him. And she died after this, all these series of articles were printed in the Post magazine. And then they were put in a book, and the book was published and distributed widely, and the book all but disappeared. The Christian Scientists systematically bought up all the copies. They bought back the rights, or somehow got the rights from the publisher, and destroyed the plates, and the book became unavailable. The only copies that were left were the copies that went to the public library. And the Christian Scientists stole the copies out of the public library and just check them out, not take them back. And so somebody realized what was going on, and the book was almost impossible to find. And in 1971, Baker Bookhouse republished it to the great service. And took all those rare copies and republished the photographic plate so that you can see kind of got an old style print. Yeah. So that the great, but before 1971, when Baker put this book was almost impossible to find. And it is a definitive history of Christian Science. The interesting thing about this, that this came out while Mary Baker Eddy was still alive. She didn't take McClure's magazine or Georgine Milne, the author, to court over it. Now that's significant because in these days she was taking everybody to court, and half her time in court, mostly suing her own people for stealing her material. And she sued everybody that came down the pipe. And but she did not take the publisher of Georgine Milne to court. But it, and the book is very active. That's the standard history. You got that in your syllabus. That's the only one. George and Mel, the life of Mary Baker Eddy. Now, here's the general history. Mary Baker Eddy was born. Baker was his maiden name, of course, in Bow, New Hampshire, with a strict Puritan kind of congregationalist upbringing. Her father was a high-tempered, dominating, narrow, hateful, divisive man. Other than that, he's a nice guy. Family had three sons and three daughters. Mary was the youngest, and to make the long story short, she was spoiled, rotten. She was spoiled, and she was one of these children who loved to. His parents were stupid enough to let her get her way by throwing tantrums. Now, I'm not going to teach my Christian family life. But the rule I give you is Christian family, every child is one thing. For life. And the parents are smart. So she got her way by beating her head on the floor and holding her breath and that kind of stuff. She did poorly in school, 1831. She was always on stage. Her parent, her grandmother, dressed her up. Whenever she was dressed up, trying to go to school, she was always dressed in frills and fur bellows and shoe dogs and whatnot. And she was always acting, always trying to. She dominated. She got older in her teens, and she dominated the household by her tantrums. She became enamored of what was called mesmerism. Now, in the 19th century, mesmerist, that was an old word for it, all these hypnotists, traveling hypnotists go around advertising mesmerism to give demonstrations, or animal magnetism to give demonstrations of it. And it was the rage. Now, this area, by the way, is the burnt over district. Remember when you said that, Mormonism? Every crazy idea that you can think of took root and grew in that part of the country. And this was one of them. And she liked that. In 1843, she married a poor unfortunate fellow named George Glover, who mercifully died of yellow fever 7 months later. By him, Mary had a son. You see, she was 22. She married him. She had a son to whom she was never a mother. Mary Baker Eddy. She was called mother. She, in her later years, she was often called mother. She had a son. She never ever raised him. The thing about him, she wouldn't have anything to do with him. Others had to raise him. One little boy. She lived around with various family members and friends. She would never work. She demanded constant attention. Every little, if every little whim was not catered to, she would faint. She would get the vapors, throw a fit. She developed a pathetic desire for swinging, of all things. And then her daddy, when she was living at home, she lived from home probably a year and lived with family. Nobody could stand her for very long. So they had comforted her. She was somewhere else for a while. Her daddy, well, even if, I understand the rooms were, if she moved around with her, whether it's possible, they would put a big swing in her room. She would sit by the iron swing. And her daddy built a cradle, a bed that was a cradle the size of a bed, small bed, with a chair on one end perpendicular to the cradle, so if her teacher could see or somebody else could sit in that chair and rock the cradle this way, and she'd be sitting this way and the cradle this way. Somebody could sit by the hour and rock her. She was an adult now, 20. She'd rock by the hour. Or swing. She dabbled in trances, mesmerism, spiritism, anything. See a pattern in that, don't you? You see that with Mormonism, you see with sun, moon, and others, spiritism. She said she could locate Captain Kidd's church. Now, word about that. One of the best of early America. Remember Joseph Smith? Was homing in on that too. One of the myths of early America was that Captain Kidd, the pirates, had buried a fabulous treasure somewhere, and everybody was always going to find it. And it may have been true, may have, but nobody ever found it. She tried her hand at writing. She thought she was an elegant soul, but she was like many writers. She started writing before she started reading, and I was studying, and as a result, it was very bad, extremely bad writing, and ornate and flowery. And, in 1851, she finally gave her son, George, his name, to a woman called Mahala Sandberg. In 1853, she married, she got her second husband, a Dr. Daniel Patterson, who was a fine fellow. He was a dentist. Her father tried his best to talk Mrs. Hudson of marrying Mary. Mary was very physically attractive. She was no pieces. And I guess Hudson had a weak moment, but he married her. And Mr. Baker told him, he said, if you marry this woman, it would be the sorriest day of your life. He really did. He tried to tell. He knew that his daughter was had a phone off the hook and would make life miserable for this poor fellow. He felt it was his duty, one man to another, to warn him. And Mr. Patterson, Dr. Patterson, married her anyway. And Mary made life miserable for her husband. There are many examples of that. One example is the real bad storm, snowstorm, rain. And he had been in the doctor,
Dr. Patrick can call somebody's house with a terrible food trouble package to work on. And so we travel quite a distance. We travel to be with these people. And Mary, I feel bad, but she sent word to her husband that she was dying, come immediately. So the flood guy traveled all night to a terrible storm, a muddy road, horses, horses. Finally got to his dying wife's bedside. Last time she was doing fine. No, nothing wrong. I'm not feeling better now. I look better right then. She did that kind of thing constantly. That's exactly what her daddy said. You can imagine that. She didn't bother her that her husband drove all night. Mary always had this fit the position that if she was there, she existed to be served, to be cared for. It never occurred to her that anybody else would consider. 1864, which was 11 years after their marriage, Patterson finally left his wife. That's all he could say. And she divorced him after he left. The next year, her father died, and her sister promptly threw her out of the house. Her father had always spoiled her, and along with everybody else, and her sisters, and while she was there, her father made her sisters take care of her. She would not pick up her own clothes, never fix a meal, never wash dishes, or anything. Everybody did the work, so they came home from the funeral, I guess, and opened the front door and set her out in her baggage. They kicked her out as soon as the old man, as soon as the old boy was in the ground. So she would live with different friends. People think you'll feel sorry for her and take her in. She sponged off everybody. It never worked, but she lived in somebody's house and offered the help. Anything. 1861, Mary is introduced to Dr. Quimby and his mental science or mental healing. He's kind of a traveling quack, and talk more about what he meant by mental science, mental healing, when it comes to our doctrinal section. In 1863, Quimby had become an obsession with Mrs. Patterson. She became a secretary for him, carried his manuscripts about. Of a disciple. Then, the next year, her father, I skipped over that. Her husband left her. The next year, her father died. She got kicked out. In 1866, Quimby died, and Mary appropriated his manuscripts. She'd been carrying around for him anyway, editing and rewriting them for him, and she just kept them. Later on, she was to tell the famous fall on the ice. This is the standard pattern for painkillers, by the way. They always got a story. Paul Roberts said he was cured of tuberculosis and he was about to die. And her story was that during this period she fell on the ice and the doctors told her she would never walk again. Her spine was never ever to be damaged. But through what will later be called Christian Science, she accepted her healing and got up and spine. But none of it was true. It's true of many of it. But that's the story that was told later. In 1867, Mary met a fellow called Hiram Crafts, who was somewhat betaken. They went to live with his family and tried to break up their marriage. Here she came access to the Lieber manuscript. And I'm going to mention that later. I'll just stick it in here if you see where it comes into her history. Another manuscript by a fellow called Lieber. During this time, she acknowledged her obligations to Quimby's writing, and she tried to develop it, this mental science. She's always interested in it before. So now she's got access to Quimby's writings and to that of Lieber, they were roughly the same kind of stuff, which we'll discuss later. In 1869, she met a young man, made a disciple of him, Richard Kennedy. She teaches him what is then called Quimbyism, which we know later is basic Christian Science. In 1870, Mary and Kennedy moved to Lynn, Massachusetts. She found that she was no good at the actual healing. Never was. Christian Science healing. Mary could never make it work. So she gave her efforts to teaching the system that she couldn't make work. And she charged $300 for a few weeks of lectures, which was quite a sum of money. But now let me stop here and then teach you something that might be important. Why would people pay $300, which would be about like closer to $3,000 now in our money, for just a few weeks of very bad lectures? I'm going to tell you, the same reason that people really go after this mind over matter business when it appears on the media television, the Christian networks, or it appears anywhere else. The idea, why do so many people go after the idea that if you have proper faith, you will be healthy and you will be wealthy. You know, God wants you well, God wants you successful, and many other things. The answer is this, that it is one of the one of the desires of man that is, that corresponds to the desire of Satan, with which Satan always tries to tempt man, and that is in the area of control. The idea of being able to control your environment, to control your world. Now that is, people want to do that. Understand? They want to control. You want to see how this gets over into other areas. There's a get into the study of modern scientism as opposed to genuine science. Modern scientism is an attempt by man to be in control. Man wants to say, this is my universe. It is what I make it. It is what I say it is. And it will be what I say it will be. And out of this kind of foolish nonsense, you get this idea that man is capable of anything. You can, you want to see, by the way, if you want to hear some of the purest forms of religious scientism preached, go through Epcot. Epcot is a very pure form of pantheistic scientism. If you can dream it, you can do it. I heard that we've got some of the themes there. And the unlimited future, the unqualified possibilities of man. Man is going to conquer the undersea world. He's going to conquer outer space. He's going to conquer disease. Who knows? He might conquer death. They don't say that out there, but that's an implication. That kind of thing. You understand? But man, and in fact, if you go through Epcot, you get genuine hymns to Mother Nature. You listen. We'll go through it next time. You listen to what's being said in many of those, pavilions. Not the parts of the world, call that. Another side of the lake. I'm talking about the one person. It is a very religious experience. So if you listen to what they say, the idea. And very, very pagan. The idea that everything, that man is in control of his universe. He can do anything he wants with it at a given time. And that's why the faith, that's why these radio prophets, they sell, it sells the idea that if you really in tune with God, then you have control over sickness, you have control over money. Pat Robertson claims to control the weather. Yes, he does. You ever hear him say that? He stopped 2 tornadoes so far. Infinite control. Man wants to control. And what Christian science does, it gives people a sense of, or it creates the myth of, control over the natural world. The natural world becomes your slave. That's why people would pay $300 to get it. People are doing the same thing today. That makes sense. That's an abstract point to make. But you see, by the way, you see the same pantheistic scientism in school textbook, just full of it. It's just pure, the unlimited possibilities of man. Now, are there any questions on that before I make that clear? And Satan offers that in any kind of guide under any label that he can. Either they'll do it in the name of the Bible, they'll do it in the name of faith, they'll do it in the name of mysticism, they'll do it in the name of paganism, they'll do it in anything. The idea that we
I've called a theological and theologian Christian, Christian Christians were called triumphalism. Man can triumph, man can be called, or sometimes called victorious living, a man that has victory or triumph and power over. It's also called name of the planet. By Western Spirit. Okay. So she's had people buying this, and she always fancied herself a teacher anyway. Not that she knew anything. By 1871, number 14, Mary is teaching Finley's method for a living. Kennedy's more successful after she is, and Mary becomes jealous. So, in 1872, they parted company. Kennedy parted company with her. Later, she vilified him. This is the pattern for her. She would gather people around her, and then she would be alienated from them, and then she would vilify them, and sometimes sue them. She spent her whole life going through people, even until she died. She would draw people close to her, and then she would be alienated from them, and then vilify them. And then somebody else would take the place. In 1875, a fellow called Daniel Spofford took Kennedy's place. And in this year, 1875, Mary published the first edition of Science and Health. Now, where did it come from? Well, we're going to talk about it later, but it came from mainly Quimby's manuscripts. Just like Mormonism and the Spaulding manuscripts, it came mainly from Quimby, although it was some aspects of Lieber's work, which I'll give this a statement on this again, so I'll get there. So she published it as under the book Science and Health. In 1877, she married Asa Eddy, her third husband, the Glover, Patterson, Dr. Patterson, the dentist, and now Eddy, which is her last husband. I put it so on the, in parentheses, on the marriage certificate, she listed her age as 40. Actually, she was 56. That used to know this. By the way, until the day she died, she wore her hair. She was a very old woman, I'd say in her 60s, 70s, 80s. She wore her hair like a young girl. Kind of like Shirley Temple type of thing. She died. Eddie was, now her marriage to Eddie was better than her other marriages, mainly because he was so much like her. He had a haphazard youth, the background in clairvoyance, other occult practices. She had the same background she did in the occult. She spent, and by, to say that the occult was quite popular on the frontier. Fortune telling, seances, that kind of stuff. Mary spent much of her time in these years suing her former students for teaching her method. That is, she didn't want anybody stealing what she had stolen. And so she did. Sometimes students would go out and try to, of course, the only strength of why she was teaching them, so they go out and try to practice it while she started suing them for stealing her method. Yet. I'll get to that later. Well, it's a good question, but a lot of rock time to answer. 1879, the Christian Science Church was chartered in Boston. In 1881, the Massachusetts Metaphysical College was organized in Boston. That was the college. It didn't last too long. In 1882, Mr. Eddy took sick. You weren't supposed to get sick if you had Christian knowledge, Christian science. And this became quite a circus. Both he and Mary believed that his illness was caused by adverse mental treatment. One of their former students who they had sued and fallen out with was a fellow called Edward Irons. They got in their head that Edward Irons was afflicting them long distance, kind of like voodoo. They called it mental arsenic poisoning. That is, he was poisoning them with arsenic mentally. Chemically. And guess who they sent for? A regular doctor. Every time Mary got sick, she sent for a regular doctor, which Christian scientists are forbidden to do. He diagnosed the sickness as common heart disease. When Mr. Eddy died, a physician called Noyes was called in for an autopsy, and the decision was that he died of heart disease. Mary published a phony physician's report by a, and in which this physician was supposed to have performed an autopsy and said that the man died of mental arsenic poisoning, but nobody knew what that was. The name on the report was Dr. J.C. Eastman. And she published this. Well, the authorities noticed it and investigated this Dr. J.C. Eastman, who performed the autopsy after the regular doctor did, and found that Andy Mr. Eddie died of mental arsenic poisoning. It proved out this investigation was not a doctor at all. He was the proprietor of an abortion mill. And this got him 10 years in prison.
Very due to me.
I'm not sure rather how much he participated in it, but brought him, Mary, by publishing this, brought him to the attention of the authorities, and they investigated him and ended up making a hope he was 10 years. So much for Dr. Eastman. By the way, that's very similar to what Oral Roberts did. Oral Roberts, early in his career, published a booklet about his own healing, and it had pictures of doctors and their testimonies, sworn testimonies, how he'd been miraculously healed. And this was investigated by some leading evangelical preachers in the age, and found out the thing was an absolute lie. Big part of the fellows whose pictures were there were not doctors. It was completely phony. This was back in the 50s, early 50s. This happened in the late 40s. So, did y'all know that? It was really late for a while. But he published a phony testimony of doctors. It's like Mary did. 1887, Mary disassociated herself from Quimby, claiming that he was nothing but a mesmerist. That is, she said, before she had promoted Quimbyism, I had identified her teaching as that of Mr. Quimby. She learned it from him. Now she changes her story and says she got it from God. She begins to say she got it from God, and Quimby, who's he? The very thing that Armstrong did with British Israelism. You know, I never heard of it. Quimby, he's just a mesmerist I knew one time. He was nothing. And her next man of all, man of all, work was a fellow called Calvin Fry. So she would get these men. Now, you might be thinking, your dirty mind, that she was cohabiting with these young men, and she probably was not. It was probably nothing immoral in the relationship. In fact, I don't think she was too interested in that kind of thing. It was very platonic. That they were just disciples. And they were her personal servants. What they were, everything she said to do, they would do. In 1888, Mary reduced her course to 3 lessons, and yet continued to charge $300, and people continued to pay it. And it's quite popular. All sickness was attributed to mental malpractice. That is, if you were sick, it means you just weren't looking at things right. She begins to organize her program and sets out to amass a fortune. Even though wealth is an illusion, she thought she would have as much of the illusion as she could possibly get. She ran into trouble this year in 1888, and Mrs. Corner treated her. Mrs. Corner's daughter was pregnant, and Mrs. Corner was a disciple of Mrs. Eddy. And Mrs. Corner's daughter, Mrs. Corner treated her own daughter by Mrs. Eddy's mental obstetrics, and both the mother and the baby died. And this brought the matter to the courts, and Mrs. Eddy abandoned Mrs. Corner. That is, she didn't stand by her, this woman. And Mrs. Corner is a very tragic figure. She believed Mrs. Eddy and her daughter wasn't getting regular medical care. There was some kind of complication with the baby. Rather than getting regular medical care, she treated her to Christian Science, and both her daughter and her and the baby died. And Mrs. Corner ended up in court, and Mrs. Eddy just said, I never heard of her. Associate herself from it. But enough of the Christian Scientists knew that Mrs. Corner had been a faithful disciple and was following Mrs. Eddy's advice to teach that the church split over that. Several hundred left the church. I don't know how many left her and fell off on their own because of the way she treated Mrs. Corner. Now, and that's also a pattern of faith healing. Teachers, faith healers regularly do this. They will teach their doctrine, and then when their disciples follow the doctrine, when somebody dies, they disassociate themselves from it.
Do you remember back in the 70s, I think it was the mid-70s, when this young man, Northern California, I think it was, this little boy died. His father had taken him to an Assembly of God church and had faith in his healing service. The boy had diabetic. And the evangelist announced that if he really trusted God, he would get rid of his insulin. It's not his faith. And so they threw the insulin away and he died. This ended up in the court. And the Assemblies of God across the country disassociated themselves from that wholesale. Like the preacher, he had something about church up the road from us. He went away the other day. And I looked at him. And he got on the radio. I heard this myself. He said, well, you know, that's unfortunate. We've never taught that. An absolute lie. Exactly what that was. Every week we taught that. That father was following their instructions exactly. You see, I've heard it, I don't know how many times. That was a complete lie. You with me? That's exactly what they taught. And this fellow had ran an ambulance to his church. And when somebody dies under it, they go, oh no, you have to do that. This is the pattern, what I'm saying.
Christian Science began to prosper in the West. Of course, every crazy idea in the world prospered in the West. Now, let me say a word about this. On the frontier, good ideas and bad ideas spread like wildfire. One of the embarrassments of the Restoration Movement is how many of the Restoration Fathers ended up in cults, Restoration Fathers, because people were, they were just like there were good people, there were unstable in many ways, tended to head to the frontier. Anytime you have a place where people go and their lives aren't working, things are falling apart, then you tend to find an area where crazy ideas take off because you tend to have concentration of unstable people. And the biggest evidence today is California. Southern California. So in Southern California, you find every crazy idea in the world alive and in business, doing very well. I mean, you cannot be crazy without trying to get a following in Southern California. Florida's getting that way. Why? Because unstable people, one of the characteristics of unstable people is unstable people think that their problem is geography. That my problem, I can just go somewhere else and my life will come together and my life will work if I just get away from here. And once in a while that's true. Usually all they do is relocate their problem. And it's always been true. Well, the frontier is like that. People, there's always free land, they always go west. And many of the frontiers were very unstable. And it was one of the really interesting to read frontier, American frontier history, to see how silly ideas really prospered when they died out and revived. And so in the West, the Quimbyism, or what we begin to call mental science or Christian science, prospered. Let's finish this history here, then we'll take our break. Mrs. Eddy adopted a son, didn't raise her own, but she adopted a son. Ebenezer Johnson Foster was 41, Mrs. Baker was 68. But this was just another one of her men who were her followers. In 1889, her health failed. She allowed the claim to be made on her behalf that she is the equal of and the chosen successor of Christ. While she herself is sick, the book, she continues to publish updated editions of Science and Health. Now, here's how she got most of her money, selling her lessons, but others were teaching them for her by now. The book was ultimately to go through 70 editions, each of which had to be purchased by the faithful. That is, what she would do is every two or three times a year, she would sell, she would make some small change in the book, claiming she got new life in heaven. Make a small change in the book, usually was mounted up. And then tell all the members of the Christian Science Church, there were a few of them, that they had to buy the newest edition because the other one was outdated. And they were overpriced. And this way, Mary assumed a fortune of over $3 million. Now that was in 1880s. That was in 1880s. Would that be worth today? It'd be closer to $30 million. Steve was the wealthiest man in America. You know that? He was. In 1892, she reorganized the church into a privately owned corporation. She wanted to control it more. They with me, it was a religious nonprofit organization before. She dissolved it and reorganized it as a private corporation, hers. In 1895, Mother Church was built in Boston, they call, still call it that. And she built an estate that called Pleasant View at Concord, New Hampshire. And she lived most of the rest of her life in seclusion, continued to write literature, and legends began to grow about her. Now, she did not live lavishly, interestingly enough. She lived comfortably, but she didn't spend a lot of money. She didn't, was not a luxuriant, ostentatious way that she lived. She grew disenchanted with Foster, remember the son, this little boy she had adopted, but he was only, what, 58, 41? She cut him off. He went back home to Vermont. One of her disciples, a woman called Josephine Curtis Woodbury, who was kind of an image of Mrs. Eddy, gave birth to a boy she called the Prince of Peace. See, Mary had been teaching all along that if a woman really had her mind right, she could conceive a baby all by herself. Immaculate conception. Well, this Miss Woodbury said she had done it. This baby was the Prince of Peace. This baby had no earthly father. Mary, who taught this doctrine, didn't believe a word of it. She declared the son illegitimate, which he was. And there was a big flap in the church over that. It was this year that she adopted the title Mother. She had disinherited from her adopted son. They'd never raised her only son, but she was Mother. 1907, the total number of Christian Scientists was 50,000. 710 branch churches, 50 of these in foreign countries, you can read the rest of that. 1910, Mary Baker Eddy died. Her followers believed, many of them, that she would rise, she would conquer death. So far as I know, she hasn't. Today, Christian Science is in serious decline. Most of its members, as I say, are middle-aged and elderly women in the more affluent areas of the United States. If you go into a Christian Science bookstore, that's who you find there. Middle-aged and older women, upper middle class, probably wealthy women. That's about all the Christian Science is made up of now. Membership peaked out at about 300,000 in the mid-1930s. That's a pretty good chunk of people in the 30s. Now it's less than 200,000. And branch churches, as branches of Mother Church in Boston, which is the headquarters, and reading rooms are being closed down every year. So it's on the decline. Every year there's fewer members, fewer churches, fewer readings. Let's take our break and then we'll talk about this.
Do you want to go out
in the cold?
I was looking at it.
It occurred to me, this exam was prepared to do the paper. Did I tell you that it was going to be authentic? Objectionable. I knew that. I don't know if I did or not. I'll just tell you now, it is part objective and part subjective. And if I misled you by telling you it's going to be all objective, then obviously we have to take the next week. But, did I say that? I don't.
You did.
I did. I was talking to Ray, and it occurred to me that I had said that, and then I just sort of struck me with that, but I maybe test out in both. Would you all prefer to say it next week?
Yeah.
I know that you study differently, but I'll take you as opposed to a subject. Okay, I'll do this. Yes. Anybody?
I've had 4 years now, I haven't made it able to tell the difference between their objectives and subjectives.
And you're great to show it. by object, by subjective, I mean short essays. By object, I mean everything else.
Object means
false. Well, objective means true and false, fill in the blank, definition, identification, that kind of thing. That subject in your essay. Now, I'm serious. I know that it wouldn't be fair to you to test you with a test that is part subject, part subject. If I told you the object, it would be fair. That word, that word. I'm yes.
Can you
do
a little more
specific on how much? No. But I thank you for asking. Let me ask you, how many of the credit students would, because like, it's not really, I'm going to be fair to you, would you prefer to take an extra? Oh, it doesn't make a difference to me. Okay, that's the majority. It, like I said, it just occurred to me, flipping the card. I'd have heard how, if I'd have handed you that test, you'd have howled, made me feel bad, I'd have probably felt bad for today. 3-4 minutes. Okay, so I'll give you another week. But okay, I'll take it next week. Also, I had some second thought. This is the banquet. This is the banquet, and I know some of you will work on the banquet. So I'll let you, but mainly because I think I might have misled you. That's right. We'll take the exam next week. Okay? Now. Yes. No. It'll be up. It will not cover Christian Science. It'll be up to communication theory. Okay? It doesn't make a difference to me what you think of this week or next week. Again. That way you can be. The guy who asked that came 10 minutes late. Get your girl waiting?
I have never problem.
Well, I'm going to go 2 minutes over. This is easy. How long it takes? The girl's going to wait.
Come on now, guys, rest my goodness.
Okay, that's foolishness. Let's get back to you some more foolishness. I find it very hard to take Christian Science very seriously. Mary Baker Eddy was mentally ill, no question about it. She may have been demon possessed, I doubt it. I think she was probably demon offset. But she was spooky. Well, she did have. The thing is, I don't mean to be facetious, the thing that leads me to say that Jesus might have been directly involved is that she did have a way of dominating people when she was around them. You've got to understand, how could she have so many followers and devout followers? And she was so weird. You know, a woman wouldn't raise her own kid, had to be rocked and big head. But she had a certain charisma, and she had a way of dominating people, even when she was younger. I mean, she could get people to serve her. She always ended up being the head of the master of any situation she was in. People would serve her. It was sort of a fascination. Yeah. It's kind of like Jim Jones, that they would, he would be possessed. I better pay for him. There was something. See, she had a background in the occult, and did Mr. Eddy, but she had this way of sort of controlling people when she was around them. It was really hard to explain. Because you just look at the data, look at the facts, and you say, how in the world did anybody take her seriously at all? But if you've been around her, you see, there are people like that. I know we had a fellow in church once. He was the kind of there, and some of you preachers may have run into somebody like this, that he was absolutely winsome. And he could pull every dirty trick in the book, and you could tell somebody about it. And he would meet that person, and in 5 minutes, they wouldn't believe a word you said. They just simply didn't believe this fellow. I first full, I only had two full-time ministries. And my first full-time ministry was just like a man. I think he had some mental problems. But he was downright, hypocritical, if nothing else, dishonest. I caught him several lies myself. When I went there, he was sort of running the church, and I left, he wasn't denominated. The other church, people not even caught on to him. But anytime people, anybody didn't know him, that was immediately, it just you could win them over just in a few minutes. Amazing. And Mary Baker Eddy was kind of like that. Isn't somebody like that? She was kind of like that. Now, whether how much the demons were involved, I do not know. But it was kind of weird. I bet you were sitting there thinking like that. Well, how could she have a phone? We look at distinctive doctrines of Christian Science. In the Christian Science Church, there are no ministers. Not like Mormonism, the Jehovah's Witness. There's no paid clergy. They conduct no weddings or funerals. The funeral kind of goes against their idea anyway. It's very secretive about its inner business. That is, its services aren't secret, but it, their financial operations, everything, very secretive. But when Christian Science people get sick, die, they have to have a funeral somewhere else. It's a funeral. Members are required to spurn secular medicine, even the taking of aspirin. The few exceptions are immunization, the setting of broken bones, obstetrical care at childbirth, but the last, obstetrical care, is permitted only because to comply with state law. And you see, Armstrong actually got told because they wouldn't even allow immunization so their children died. Yes. Yes, that's right. At least that's pretty well established. She was okay. I'm glad you reminded me of that. Yeah.
Did you say that
the
seminary, they just have
several ceremonies? No, they have many churches or civil ceremonies. Ailing members, somebody gets sick, here's how they're treated. They read selected passages from Science and Health. We'll talk about what the kind of thought they think in a minute. A practitioner who rarely visits the sick person stays home and thinks about him. He prays for him during the day and charges him $2 to $15 a day. By the way, in the Christian Science, everything is done for money. Mary Baker Eddy established that way. There is a charge for everything. Now, let's say a word about that. In our churches, we don't normally think that way. We pay a preacher for a funeral and for a wedding, part of the time, most of the time anyway, and that's about it. We don't realize that in denominational churches, especially high churches, high liturgical churches, there's a fee for everything. You know, in some churches, especially in the East, you pay a fee, and then you just reserve a pew for you. Nobody else can sit in that pew all the time. That you, I never will forget when I was a young man, converted this fellow who had been raised Lutheran for all his life, and baptized him. And we went to the vestry room, and he asked, "Well, how much are you?" We were talking about life, and the fellow, that's the way he was raised, you know, and he paid a fee for everything. And had a special on that week. when I explained that, I didn't operate that way, you know, it wasn't easy to pay for God. And that kind of brought home to me that, you know, I said in real life. Well, Christian Science is worse than that. Everything is paid for. The Christian Science Church has about 33 rest homes where the old and the infirm can be made comfortable while treatment of prayer. If the person is to pray, read the Bible, read this book, Science and Health, and then their practitioner, who's supposed to be more advanced in the art of Christian Science, they pray for them and think about them and transfer this mental energy to them. Help keep their mind straight away. Did you ever read the Christian Science Monitor? It's excellent newspaper. Now, that is, by the way, it's won five Pulitzer Prizes. Five. Now, I never subscribed to it, but I've always thought about it, but I never got around to it. The news reporting is very accurate, very good. Now, of course, you read over it, you don't pay attention to the doctrine and stuff. It's one of the best news
If you want to get the news, what's going on, some of the best newspapers. Professor Bourne, I think he's the head of the Christian Science Monitor, has to be here. Many preachers, I recommend him. It's quite expensive. That's just an excellent newspaper. All good stuff. That's strange, it would be, they do it.
Christian Science is basic metaphysical dualism. Let me come back to that. The Bible, in regard to the Bible, Christian Science affirms that the Bible contains errors, but this book is inerrant. For instance, Mary Baker Eddy said that the Old Testament Genesis teaching that God created the material world is ridiculous. That's not true at all. Neither Satan nor sin exist. I'll come back to that. I'll talk about dualism. The Christ, what she says about Jesus is that what the Christness about Jesus was his Christian Science. That is, he had this knowledge that she had. She had the same revelation that she had, kind of like Sun and Moon, you know, the next Christ. And that was what was the Christ about him. Otherwise, he was just a man, like she was. Well, she presented herself as a female Christ. That is, she was in the female what Christ was in the male. Because, are you with me? Christ means this Christian Science, this knowledge. It's very pantheistic. Every human being is just as much a part of God as Messiah. Even Jesus made mistakes, she says. You know what pantheism, that God, God kind of impersonally indwells all the world. She denied the doctrine of atonement. Why? Because you cannot atone for sin because sin doesn't really exist. And since Jesus didn't really die, he did not rise from the dead. Other than that, it's Christian. I told you before, it's not Christian or science. Where did this teaching come from? I've already mentioned Quimby and Lieber. And I give you a short statement about that there in the syllabus. She copies it. You can really tell because this book is fairly well written. In a literary sense, it was written by somebody with certain literary skills. And it doesn't make a lot of sense. My standard recommendation is you can sit down with Science and help me start reading it. I've done it. Just try to read through it. And if it starts making sense to you, quit reading immediately because you're way ahead of her. But it really is. If you just sit down and read it, it's very confusing. Mystical. But now, her other writing, remember I said she retired into Pleasant View, spent her later years writing? Stuff that she wrote, clearly wrote, is very crude, very poorly written. Just wouldn't be, I mean, it's very clear. The person who wrote that stuff did not write this book because she was not well educated. She just did not. She just didn't, you know, good grammar, didn't have a very good vocabulary. So what she did write is very crude. So this is pretty well written, literate. Now, let me talk about Christian Science. And students who've had me before are going to recognize this as old Platonic dualism, which is, with which traditional Orthodox theology is infected through Augustine and Calvin and Luther and others. But metaphysical dualism, okay, ready to go? I'm kind of easy so far, kind of entertained you. Mm-hmm. So much entertained to talk about Mary Baker Eddy, one of my favorite people. But I'll bring you down to work. I have to thank you for the next few minutes.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah.
Metaphysical dualism. Now, what the word dualism means, what's the word dual mean? Two. And what a dualism is, any kind of metaphysical means having to do with the basic nature or character of reality, of things. Metaphysical, okay. Now, metaphysical dualism is the idea. Well, metaphysical dualism, I'm not speaking of its source, demonic source, really, but it is, in its very
what it tries to do is to explain the presence of evil in a world created by a God who is supposed to be good. That's the basic problem. Why is there evil in a world created by a God and overseen by a God who is a good God? But we know the Christian answer to that. And the way to dualism says that there's not one world, but there are eternally, that is, there are eternally two worlds. There is the physical world, and there is the non-physical world. And they are eternally and intrinsically, essentially, separated. Hence the term dualism. They never meet, as it were. Not really. They are two separate entities, and eternally so. Now learn this. Dualism is a basic approach. There are many versions of it. I'm going to mention some of it in the process of what I'm going to teach you now. But there are other versions of it. This is basic. There are many expressions or versions of it. And this non-physical world in basic dualism is the world that's good, and this world here is evil. This is the world of reason. This is a world of quote knowledge. But this knowledge is non-rational. Non-rational knowledge. Intuitional knowledge or transcendent knowledge. We'll talk about those things later. Okay. Now, another key thing about this dualism, is that this world is basically, this is the real world. This world is either a reflection or an illusion. Now it depends on which version of dualism we're talking about. Either a reflection or an illusion. Now, this dualism, for instance, this is Buddhism. You recognize it? This is Buddhism. In Buddhism, I'll extend this line over here, yes, and I'm not teaching questions. In Buddhism, you start out in this world, and then you're incarnated into this world, and you start the wheel of life, a series of reincarnations, and depending on the quality of your life, you go around and around. Ideally, you will keep going until eventually you arrive here. Now, if you're really rotten, you go the other way. You go from being a man to a worm. But if you're good, then you get to be, you go from being a slug, a toad, up to a dog, to a cow, which is pretty sacred. Hinduism. Buddhism broke off from Hinduism, by the way. This is Hinduism, maybe. Sacred dualism up there. And so, now a Brahma, and then if you keep living good, You get to be a man, and then you get to be a higher class of man. You go to the caste system in India, or Burma. So that, and the highest caste of man is a Brahmin. And a Brahmin, eventually, if you begin to live super, like some of the Buddhist monks, then you escape the physical altogether, and you're lost in this impersonality godness and nirvana. You have that? You escape the physical altogether. You keep going up. For a while, you're purely physical, then you get into the spiritual and non-physical realm, then you, ideally. If you're ever going to read a good account of this, if you want to get a good insight into this without working too hard,
read Rudyard Kipling's fairly short story called Kim. It's a television special made of it last year, I think. Kim, the old Buddhist monk that he befriends in the process of whole thing. Explain all the things.
You're getting a little bit chilly for me to quote, though.
Now,
this is Hinduism. This is Zoroastrianism. This is Manichaeism. This is Buddhism. It is Christian Science. It is, and these ideas have come into Christian theology. It is Platonism. Plato. Philosophic dualism. Okay? Now, the way this works is that salvation, in a dualistic system, salvation, using it as a general term, not in the Christian sense, but whatever it is, salvation equals escaping this world and getting into this world. You see this?
Over here, Buddhism. And you keep circling and circling until finally, here we are, incarnation. You don't get reincarnated in a physical body at all, but you're safe in this world.
By the way, this is also transcendental meditation, which is Hinduism. How do you transcend? Well, you transcend by meditation, feel self-hypnosis, until you float free of the body.
Same thing. Now, in this, for instance, Platonism, remember, in the Plato's Republic, he gets into this in his the idea of the Republic is this perfect communist society in which the philosophers are the kings. And he's talking about, in the section, when he talks about the training of the philosophers, kind of thinking the philosopher king who runs the perfect republic is, that's always an ideal. He explains this the kind of basic thinking they would do with the famous allegory of the cave, or Plato's allegory of the cave, in which he says, all reality is like this. It's like a man who's born in a cave, and he's tied to a stake, so that he's tied such a way he can never see himself. He never sees himself. Behind him, a fire is burning, and this is because the fire is behind him, his reflection is on the cave wall. And also, all of his life, he cannot see himself, but he can see the reflection on the wall. And he looks at the reflection on the wall, and he thinks that's him. And this allegory of the cave, this world is the reflection on the cave wall. And this world is the man himself. And wisdom, then, is to realize that this world is a reflection or an illusion of the real world. And that the real world, this world is the real world. Now, in Christian Science, all that Christian Science is basic metaphysical dualism, in which, let me interrupt myself. To show you how pervasive this idea is, Satan uses this idea everywhere he can because it works so well. When something works, you don't stay with what got you there. And, for instance, Gnosticism, by the time the New Testament period is closing, the writing of the New Testament, one of the latest letters written, the epistles of John, 1st and 2nd John, were written about these false teachers. John says in 1st John chapter 2, these things I write concerning those who are trying to deceive you. They were called, those Docetists are, in retrospect, they call them proto-Gnostics, the beginnings of Gnosticism. Gnosticism is the second century. First century called Docetists. From the Greek word doketo, which means to see. That is, they said that Jesus, what they were saying, and this is, of course, the only place where the word Antichrist appears in the New Testament. Who is the Antichrist, John says? The one who denies that Jesus came in the flesh. You know, that word Antichrist is the first book of Daniel, not the book of Revelation. It's nothing to do about the future. It is this. They were the one, and the word Antichrist means substitute Christ. They were substitute for the real Christ, who was born of a Virgin Mary, born in, you know, John was, anyway, they said that Jesus,
Jesus was good, perfectly good, right? The Bible teaches that. He's tempted in all points like as we are, yet without sin. Well, they said, if he is good, then he could not have been physical. Why? Because the physical world is evil in and of itself. It's heinous. He had been physical and evil. So they said, Jesus did not come in the flesh. Who is the Antichrist? One denies that Jesus came in the flesh. They were substitute Christ. And he said, by the way, John was dealing this dualism. His dualism was old. Buddhism was older Christianity. But Plato lived long before Christ did. And this way of thinking was embedded in the Hellenistic society. The church fought it early on. And John does battle with it in the prologue of his gospel. What phrase in the prologue of his gospel flattens this idea? It really may have been better than Testament. I'm not about the gospel. You're thinking about the epistle. The Word became what? The Word became flesh.
Well, he was setting himself against the cultural mythology of the day.
Now, see, it's supposed to work the other way. The idea of the flesh was to transcend out, and so the Word became flesh. It's impossible. Impossible. Things cannot work that way. Jesus could. So Jesus, the docetus, the Greek word doketo, to seem, Jesus only seemed to be a man. The incarnation was an illusion, only seemed to die. And John says, you are denying Christ. Y'all get that? So, now, in the second sense, they're called Gnostics, from the Greek word gnosis, for knowledge. What they were teaching is that true knowledge is non-rational. The Gnostics. The Gnostics were the first ones to say this, and Gnosticism is a Christian heresy. The Christians adopted this dualism, defined the gospel in terms of this metaphysical dualism. They were the first ones who said things something like this. Well, you can look at the words of the Bible and understand the grammar and the syntax, the definitions and the vocabulary, and still not get the real meaning. Ever heard that? In Calvinism, it's called illumination. Why? Because reason is down here, the truth is up here in this dualism. One more example in the early history of the church. Ever students, I taught you about Marcion, this heretic, second and third century heretic, Marcionite. Marcion was a fellow that went to Rome, and he said that the God of the Old Testament created this physical world, the God of the New Testament created this world up here. Therefore, because the God of the Old Testament was an evil demiurge or an evil demon type spirit, he rejected anything that had to do with the Old Testament. He rejected the Old Testament, all the Jewish elements of the New Testament, which left him the writings of Paul, and he edited those. Why? Getting rid of everything below the line, you see. And the church declared him a heretic. That was another example of this, isn't it? Because the God of the Old Testament created what? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. So that was the evil world. Therefore, he was the evil God. And the Buddhists, for instance, say that evil demons, evil spirits created this world, and good spirits created this world. And they never touched, understand? That's what dualism means. Any questions on that? Well, now, Christian Science, that's Christian Science. Instead of Gnostic, I said the Gnostic, the Greek word for Gnostic is what? Or Gnostic is the Greek word for what? Gnosis, knowledge. What did I say Christian Science meant? Science? Yeah, it is science. What Christian Science is simply Gnosticism. That is, what they meant by science, what Mary Baker Eddy and Quimby and Lieber and all those guys meant by science, Gnostics meant by knowledge, the same word, Christian knowledge, true knowledge. Now listen to me, Christian science is this. Christian science is the recognition of this as reality. Which means that if this is the way things are, then evil is an illusion. The devil is evil. Therefore, the devil what?
does not exist. Sin is evil, therefore sin does not exist. That's right. Pain, pain is evil, therefore pain does not exist. Now, if you're hurting, that shows that your thinking is defective. As soon as you get your thinking straightened out and realize that this pain cannot exist, then you won't hurt anymore. Mind over matter. And by the way, this works a little bit. Remember, she started as a mesmerist, hypnotist. Hypnotism does a little bit of this. And that is, hypnotism creates this illusion that a person submits to hypnotism. Then the hypnotist can deal directly with their subconscious mind. And by the way, I would never let anybody hypnotize me if I had a very good reason to do it and trusted them implicitly. It's very dangerous to open your mind or your door your mind open. But anyway, hypnotist speaks directly to the subconscious mind so that the mind is convinced of something that defies the physical body, and you can have painless surgery with the right patient. Somebody's really susceptible to being hypnotized, some more than others, because the mind sort of rules out the pain. But it's not this dualism, it's simply a physiological phenomenon. Did you ever play the trick? We did this when we were in college at the time, Bible college. Awful. We had this friend of ours, and we decided we were going to make her sick one day. And we got up in the morning and went, did you feel all right? Next person came up and said, you know, go to sleep. About the fifth person on a rock, she goes, by 1 o'clock, she was sitting there. She said, that doesn't look bad? Yeah. I mean, you know, I do feel bad, you know. And just pop yourself in, you know, she's weak and that's good. Awful. I will be home. Now, and so we know there is an element of truth in mind over matter, isn't it? And this is how the power of suggestion or auto-suggestion, you all know about this, don't you? And it works up to a point. Of course, the problem with it is that death is also an illusion. So if you understand it perfectly, the reality, if you have real Christian science, then you shouldn't die. Well, that was a logical conclusion of it, and it was being broadly said about Mary. It's not clear whether she ever said it, but it was said about her by those around her as she approached death that she would either not die or she would rise from the dead, because that was the logical end of her teachers. Death is an illusion from the Buddhist. Pain is an illusion. Wealth is an illusion. She accumulated a lot of it. She spent her whole life making money. She's very good at that. But this is Christian science. Does it make sense to you? And you understand the system? Yeah, punch in the mouth of the loon. Now, what you do is, what you do is, when you get sick, you read Christian Science, which presents this basic idea to you, which convinces you that you really, this is an illusion.
Would you agree that the realism
of ancient philosophy? Oh, yeah. As you know, I taught you as a student, of course, the church history course, that Augustine was a Neoplatonist. He was a dualist. He was also a Manichaeist. And he was converted by Ambrose, the bishop of Milan, and he decided that he would rewrite Christian theology in terms of his own experience, which he interpreted in terms of dualism, and this came into Christianity, so that the physical, the evil, this is where the idea of celibacy came from, the priest was married, by sexual, physical, and evil. A priest takes a vow of poverty and chastity. You see this, for instance, Roman Catholic and Protestant theology. I'll give an example. You ever heard the word transubstantiation? Roman Catholic doctrine of the Mass and the Lord's Supper. And what they say is this, is when the priest performs the miracle of the Mass, then the loaf and the bread and the wine become the historic body and blood of Christ, that and nothing else. So if you say to a priest, after the miracle has been performed, take the wine and the bread to a laboratory and look under a microscope, what would you see? Bread and wine or flesh and blood? Oh, you would see bread and wine physically, but what it really is, actually,
is the historic body of other contact. Now, you see this in all of faith healing, by the way. You ever hear a faith healer teach you that you claim your healing on the basis of the promise of God, and even though the symptoms persist, you still hurt, you have God's word for it that you are healed, therefore you affirm your healing, you know, and on faith. You affirm it before you get it, understand? Because actually you've got it. You really are healed. The physical symptoms may be there for a while, like you may die of it. But really you are healed. Now, a lot of people don't realize a lot of testimonies of healing are just that. People understand this system. Are you healed? Yes. If you don't claim it, then you never get it. Now, of course, you don't see that in any of this in the Bible. Nobody in the Bible ever claimed to be healed or ever healed. It was never said about them. In other words, a man who was crippled wasn't healed until he could walk. A man who was leprous wasn't healed until he was clean. A man who was blind wasn't healed until he saw. Question back in the point. Because they had an organization to perpetuate it. Now you get an organization to perpetuate it, and the world always has gullible people who stand in line to buy it. Well, I would point out, look how many people support Jim Baker, Pat Robinson, and what they teach is exactly this.
How baptism by salvation or baptism with the aid of immersion is impossible.
Yes. See, in this dualism, faith ends up here. Faith is essentially non-rational. That's why, for instance, all of Catholicism and all of Protestantism teach that the mind, unaided by the Holy Spirit, can understand the words of the Bible, but not the real meaning. Metaphysical dualism. Of course, the fact is that the meaning of the Bible resides in the meaning of the word. The word revelation. The Bible never says that. And that faith is up here, and faith is inherently separated from the physical world. And baptism, as a matter of fact, is a physical act. You put it on my name. Baptism is
that word from the bottom.
Yes. Baptism is a work. Yeah, faith is, yeah, and by the way, yeah, that's right. Faith is works. Faith is up here, works are down here. You see, Calvin and Luther were Augustinians in their thinking. They say they are. And when they came to James and to Romans, where Paul talked about faith versus works, they just fit it right into their dualism. Baptism is a work, it's physical. And have you ever heard this? Now, some of our men are saying this. Some of our men who are in our graduate school, I'm reading with, they're saying things like this. You can never bring about a spiritual end by a physical act. You never bring about a physical end result by a physical act. That's metaphysical healing. That's not the way the world is. And baptism is ruled out. Baptism cannot be a part of faith because it's physical. That's basically the problem. In a sense, if they have faith and worship in terms of dualism, which is not biblical. You were next. We will pass your question. I got raised. I'm sorry. I didn't stop the time. Other
question?
No. No. They don't have to.
They don't have
lectures
and stuff like that. What would the service be like if they
have
on Sunday?
Not like lectures. Singing and lectures. Praise. We'd probably all go different from ours, you know. We'd have to watch something like that. Yeah. Well, Unitarians are something different. Either side of the line. So we're getting something on that in either. They just have, they have what they call practitioners who like. Yes. Well, you know, as your faith is, so do you have to do that. What they do, they interpret the teachings of Jesus in terms of metaphysical realism. So if you name it, you claim it, then you get it. The fact you have a God to get it doesn't mean you're sure you know you don't have it. Yeah. Of course, you see, the modern faith theory has exactly the same problem that Mary Baker Eddy and Christian Science had, is that people die. And you see, if the presence of sickness is the absence of faith, and this is exactly what all Roberts teaches and Captain Cruelan taught, the Public Image of God, the basic idea that the presence of sickness is the absence of faith.